Jewish Education and Media is pleased to present L'Chaim, a program that highlights the people, issues, and events of importance to the Jewish community. Now here is your host, Rabbi Mark Golub.
I'm Mark Golub, and the best musical of 2018 was a story about an Egyptian band that loses its way on a planned trip to the Arab Cultural Center in Petah Tikva and winds up in Bet HaTikva, a small Israeli Negev town in nowhere, where the band spends the night in the company of local Israelis. And not only wind up making music with Israelis in the town, but create a touching camaraderie between people who once had been strangers to one another. Of course, the Broadway musical is an adaptation of the hit movie The Band's Visit, with Tony Shalhoub winning a Best Actor Tony Award as the Egyptian Colonel Zakaria, and Katrina Lenk winning a Best Actress Tony as the charismatic Israeli Dina, who drives the action, with music and lyrics by Tony Award winner David Yazbek, and book by Tony Award winner Itamar Moses, directed by Tony Award winner David Cromer. And the creative genius responsible for The Band's Visit, which won 10 Tony Awards, including Best Musical, is Tony Award producer Oren Wolf, president of Networks, who has also won Tonys for the musical Once, Beautiful, the Carole King musical, the revival of Fiddler on the Roof, and the revival of Orphans. Oren Wolf also won a Grammy Award for the Best Musical Theater Album, and Oren Wolf was awarded the T Fellowship for Creative Producing at Columbia University in conjunction with Hal Prince, and is now the fellowship's director. And if you haven't seen The Band's Visit on Broadway, you have until April 7th to do so, for the musical scheduled to end its Broadway run on April 7th. And Oren, it is such a kick for me to meet you, and it's wonderful to having you at this table. Thank you for joining me on L'Chaim.
Thanks for having me.
So first, I want to understand a little bit about you. Where were you born? You know, your father happens to be in the studio, and your father and I have been having a relationship on the telephone, and I'm so glad he's in the room right now. Where were you brought up?
Cleveland, Ohio.
Cleveland, Ohio. You have a brother.
Yes.
An older brother.
Yes.
What was your Jewish home like, Oren, growing up in Cleveland, Ohio?
It was just like my non-Jewish home. They were very. I was raised Reform. I went to a couple of Jewish schools growing up. I was sort of in and out of a few different Jewish schools.
Ended up at a young age,
and then ended up at a preparatory school that was not Jewish. And I think, like most, or like many young Americans, I was sort of bar mitzvahed, at which point I kind of, you know, branched out a little.
Yes.
I've
never heard it described that way. Branched out.
Religiously speaking. I didn't join another religion, but, you know, I was sort of finding my own way in trying to sort out what, you know.
At what age?
At 13. I mean, I started that, you know. You kind of go through that process of studying to be a bar mitzvah.
13-year-olds are so young.
They seem that way to me now.
Yes. Your bar mitzvah ceremony nice?
I thought it was wonderful.
Warm memories?
Yeah, it was really nice. I remember it was catered by Hunan's. We had Chinese food, which I loved at the time. And we had it was on a roof. The congregation was the Sinai Synagogue, was a synagogue we went to.
Who was the rabbi?
Rabbi Pickles.
Nice guy?
As far as I remember, I mean, he was like, I certainly remember what he looked like. I was pretty young, but it was, yeah, I had a great experience with it. And
But after that, were you out the door?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is true from
a lot of people,
absolutely.
Right? And now I married an Israeli woman, and Shiri, my wife, and we have two kids who are now in Jewish school, and who are learning Hebrew because it was my wife's first language. So we've sort of found a way back into a Jewish circle. But yeah, that was my.
Was there Shabbat in your home growing up? Friday night.
I mean, I have some memories of it. Yeah, there was at my dad's house. There was more regularly than at my mom's, but. Yeah, I mean, I have memories
Seder?
Of Shabbat. Not really. Oh, Passover, yeah. We had Passover Seder, yes.
Was that nice?
Yeah, I always loved it. I remember we had cousins in Cleveland who were very religious, and I remember sometimes going there and just starving when we were going for when we were going for breakfast. I remember that being a very long dinner.
Uh-huh.
But I think our Passover Seders were always nice as I remember them, and we have them now with my kids, and I think I try to do it in a similar way.
That's lovely.
Tell stories.
How do you end up in Israel?
You mean to visit?
Yeah.
How old? Oh, my first time I went with my mother when I was 11. And we have cousins there. So we were there on a trip. I think I was there for 2 weeks maybe.
At 11?
At 11
That's
years old.
That's also very young.
Yeah, it was. Again, you know,
you
we had some relatives.
You remember it all?
Yeah, I do remember that trip, actually, because I remember connecting with some of my cousins then and people who are now back in my life. But I didn't go back again until I started dating my current wife, who's Israeli. And then
How
we started going
her?
Back a lot.
How did you meet her?
She was, we were set up through a mutual friend.
Nice.
She was at law school. I was trying to be going to the theater business, so it was a perfect economic fit. And we began dating, and I remember not so long after we started, maybe like a year into our relationship, we ended up in Israel and had been back. We were pretty much going every year for a while. Now that we have two kids and you don't, you know, we're past that point where you get free seats on the plane,
yes.
So we're not going every year anymore.
Where does her family live in Israel?
Her father's in Haifa and her mother's in her mother's in America. Her mother, my wife and her mother moved to America when she was young. But her mother's family's all in Tel Aviv and around.
So when you go to Israel and you're visiting her family, it was Haifa and Tel Aviv.
We go back and forth, yeah.
Okay. You then have experienced now as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
What does it feel like when you're there now?
Oh, we have a great time. It's just great. I mean, we love it. My kids have been there a lot. We always, you know, get a nice place in the city, and it's just a... We have a great time. My kids have a lot of family to play with and be with. And I've had, over the years, a lot of work that has kind of involved places and people in Israel. So that's been fun for me to get to go and do.
How did that happen? What was that work?
Well, certainly with the band's visit. I had my relationship with Iran Kohler and the filmmaker.
Okay, but you were doing this before the band's visit.
But I've been working on the band's visit a long time, since 2000. I think I saw the movie in 2007, so it's been a while. I also worked on a theater company that's in Yaffa called Nalagat, which is a blind deaf acting company that's right there on the pier. And the woman that used to run it, I don't think she's there anymore, Adina Tal, a friend of mine in New York, and I worked with her to raise money, and we actually brought her to the Skirball Center, the theater company. We brought like 30, a company of about 30 people over from Israel, many of whom were these actors who were blind and deaf.
By the way, it had a huge following in New York.
It got very good reviews.
Yes, it did.
It was sort of an extraordinary show that was kind of a memory play of all of these actors, again, who were all blind and deaf, sort of telling stories about their lives now as they experience them, some of them telling stories about their memories of being a kid when they used to have sight and hearing. And the way it was told is when the audience is walking in, they're kneading dough, and this is how it's performed in Israel, or was then. I think now they do another show, but this show was called Not by Bread Alone.
Yes.
There's the whole back of the stage is lined with ovens, and so
yes.
When they're done kneading the dough, they put it in the oven, and then during the whole performance, which was just over an hour, the bread is baking.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole theater just begins to smell like bread. And then at the end of the show, the whole audience is invited up on stage to eat the bread, and it's sort of this really beautiful experience. In Israel, where they perform, they're connected to a restaurant where you're served by blind waiters, and you eat in the dark. It's called the Blackout Restaurant, and we actually recreated that in New York under the Skirball Center. We created a restaurant. Danny Meyer did the menu, and we created a fully functional blackout restaurant by blind waiters.
Oh, Oren, it sounds magnificent, you know?
And even beyond that, at the concession stand, before and after the show, when you order like refreshments and snacks, you're served by deaf waiters, deaf staff. So all of the menu items have signs that if you want to order anything, you have to use sign language.
Okay, and tell me, how did you get involved in that? I understand where it went when you brought it here, but how did you get involved
in that? A friend of mine, a guy, a really talented producer and agent, a guy named Tommy Kriegsman, pitched me on the idea. He knew that I had a relationship to Israel. I think I had already started working on this film, The Band's Visit, the adaptation. So he knew I had an appreciation for it, and he was getting involved with them and asked me if I would help him. So I signed on. I went and saw the show and loved it. It's a kind of an extraordinary piece of theater.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
You must be very proud of that.
I'm very proud of it. It was a non-for-profit thing. You know, we didn't do it for the money. We just did it to sort of present this theater company that I thought was doing something kind of extraordinary and cutting edge in a lot of ways.
It was.
Yeah. It's extraordinary work.
And again, it was received very well, the Skirball Center and in America in general.
Yeah.
So
actually they did. They went on and did a little tour that I wasn't involved with, but there was, I think, a little tour of it. Went to a few cities. And mm-hmm. Yeah, I was really proud of my association
with
that.
Yes, you should be. I don't know why I'm assuming this, because it may not be fair. I'm assuming that in terms of the political spectrum, you and your wife lean left in a liberal way.
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think so. Yeah, I think, I guess it's all subjective, but yeah, I think we lean left.
Okay.
Yes.
And do you have affection for Israel? Does your wife have affection for Israel?
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of American Jews who don't. But most American Jews have never been to Israel.
Yeah. Well, I think it's complicated. I don't have an easy relationship with Israel in any way. Mm. My relationship is very complicated. My wife's relationship with it is very complicated.
What's the most complicated part?
The muddiness of it all. I think there's a lot of challenges. I don't feel like I'm really the right spokesperson to talk about this and to talk about the politics of Israel, because it's not something I spent any real part of my life working on or thinking about. So I just don't consider myself an expert. I feel fairly uninformed about most things in the world, including Israel. But I can certainly, I feel that there is just a lot of political muddiness, and I think there's a lot of things that go on in and around that country, not unlike our country, mm-hmm. that require us to lean in and ask questions and challenge and provide a spotlight so that we can really see things as clearly as possible. I don't think what I'm saying is eloquent, but what I feel confident that as an American Jew, I'm very proud of being Jewish. And I identify strongly as a Jew. I feel, at least the way I was raised, that it's my responsibility to judge people and countries and governments and choices on a human level, mm-hmm. about how I react to things. I also acknowledge that I'm, like I said earlier, I feel very uninformed, so I'm not an expert.
That's very honest, and I appreciate it.
Yeah.
You're bringing your children up with a Jewish identity.
Yeah.
Okay. In some way, even more than you had as a child?
I don't know.
Have you ever thought of it that way? I mean, maybe.
No, I've never compared it. My father is, I think, more of an observant religious Jew than I am, and has more of a connection to the religion than I do.
I'm talking about identity, not necessarily observance.
Right, no, you asked me to compare it to mine, so I'm just trying to compare it.
I wonder if
we are doing Shabbat in my house on Friday night.
I mean, I'm just guessing based on what I've heard. If I had met, if as an adult I'd met you when you were 13, and I'm going to meet now as an adult your children at 13, my guess is they will have, it's not about being more Jewish, but that somehow they will feel connected to it in ways that you did not. Is that fair, or you think I'm wrong?
I think so. I think having an Israeli mother is an important part of it. My kids, you know, my daughter's 7 years old. She's been to Israel 5 times. So she'll, you know, that means something for a Jewish identity. I don't think it's a religious thing, but certainly, yeah. She's also being raised in New York City, where it's like, it's just a very Jewish city. And I was raised in Cleveland, and really the school that I went to for most of my, the school I went to the longest as a child, I was a minority, serious minority. So, yeah, I think you're probably right.
When, not a political, I don't want to say nothing with politics. When you think of the time you've been in Israel, is there anything you can point your finger to? Is there any memory you have that just makes you happy? You know, if somebody said to you, what's the most special thing for you about Israel, what would you say?
I mean, there's so many things I love about it. I have a real affection for Tel Aviv as a city. The family I have there, the people I've befriended there. I have a real, you know, I grew up, when you grow up as a kid in Cleveland, the way I grew up with my Jewish identity, you know, Israel was this sort of, this great hope, you know, as a young country and paving the way for a Jewish identity that was different than what sort of came out of Eastern Europe. You know, there was this idealism to it. And I just feel like, so when you go to, when I go to Israel now and I experience it, there's a lot of things that I can kind of pull from that that I think are real. Mm-hmm. There's, it's a beautiful place. I think there's a real, there is a real love of life in a lot of the communities that I'm in. I think there was a great interest, you know, when I, especially like my relationship with someone like Iran, who I think is one of, you know, the greatest artists I've come to know in my life as a writer and as a filmmaker and just as a thinker. I've had so many warm experiences with him and with my family and with the artists that I've met in and around Israel. So I don't know, and the food, great produce.
That's a wonderful answer, by the way. That's a wonderful answer. Okay, so tell me about the band's visit and you. The band's visit is not your first production. You'd already been involved, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I've produced smaller shows on my own, and I've been a co-producer on shows on Broadway where a co-producer is someone who's really putting money together and bundling money and bringing investors in and then supporting the show financially.
You're not a lead producer.
The Band's Visit is the first show I've been a lead producer on Broadway.
Okay. Had you been close to a lead producer before that? In other words, had you worked closely with?
Yes. Yeah, I spent most of my time in the city working for producers.
Okay, so you,
being
you
in
knew
offices.
This was something you had a real feel for already.
Yeah, I mean, I pretty much have only, I've exclusively made a living in the theater business since I got out of college, with the exception of 1 year. But yeah, I pretty much only worked in the theater industry. I never really went to graduate school, so I kind of just learned on the street, you know, working in different offices, producing, marketing, management.
So how do you trip over Ben's visit?
I was with my wife.
Yes.
We were seeing... we went to the Other Israel Film Festival, which is this thing on the Upper West Side at the JCC. Isaac Zablocki and Carol Zabar's, this film festival that has a particular angle, which we were always interested in and supported. And they were showing the band's visit in 2007. It was an early screening, I believe. And I just turned to my wife at the end of the movie, right when the credits were rolling, and I told her I wanted to turn it into a stage show. I just had this sort of very clear idea of what I thought it could be and instantly kind of fell in love with that idea, and also had like a clarity of with the idea was very clear in my mind.
Well, that must have been exciting for you.
Yeah, it was very
because
exciting.
Because it doesn't always happen that way.
No.
The clarity.
No.
You could see it.
Yeah. I felt like it was a good idea. I felt like it was the right idea.
Okay, I want to push you. What was it about the story that somehow touched you so profoundly?
Well, there were sort of, now I've gone through lots of, I've answered this question before, so now I think I've organized my thoughts in a very convenient way. I'm sure at the time I was a neurotic mess.
I should try to figure out a better way to ask it.
No, it's a perfectly legitimate question, but the answer is...
Our audience should understand, it didn't start out for you as a musical.
It didn't, well, I never thought of myself as, I still don't think of myself as much of a, if you ask me what kind of theater producer I am, I don't consider myself a musical theater producer or a play producer.
But am I correct, though, that you start in your mind, when you talk about the clarity, you saw it as a stage play, not as a musical?
My honest answer is I don't think I was thinking about it either way.
One way or the other.
Yeah, it was unimportant to me.
Am I wrong that somebody at one point came to you and said, Oren, this should be a musical?
No.
Okay. Then how does it evolve from you're seeing it, saying, I want to do this show, and it doesn't have to be, you're not watching a movie that's a musical.
No, well, you're watching a movie with a lot of musical elements. I mean, the things in the movie that I always felt were just sort of inherently theatrical and exciting to me was this notion of, as you describe this plot, it's about these Egyptians that get lost for a night in the Negev. And I think this idea of isolation and being stuck with strangers is inherently a theatrical idea. There's a lot of things that movies do better than plays. However, the idea of being stuck is something I actually think works better in a stage than it does on a camera. No offense to Aaron's film, which I thought was brilliant. But I just thought that was an inherently theatrical concept. And a lot of the plays that I studied and loved at a younger age, plays by Beckett and Chekhov and Ionesco and some of the, Eugene O'Neill, these playwrights wrote about this idea of being stuck in one place. That's a very common theatrical theme. So that the movie lent itself to that. I loved the notion that it was about these musicians who were, in a very practical way, forced to carry their instruments with them the whole night. And I thought that was ripe for musicalization. And this idea of Arabic music and Middle Eastern music and Israeli music on stage and on Broadway felt like a great opportunity because it felt new, it felt unexplored. And I always, the third element that I always keyed into right away, one of the things I always loved about it was that it's about people speaking in English as a second language, because these Egyptians and these Israelis only by coincidence happen to share English. That's their second language. That's the only way they have to communicate with each other, which I think is romantic. I think it's beautiful. I think it's theatrical, because anyone who's listened to someone speak in a second language can understand that it takes more effort. You actually have to think much harder about each word. You have to be more selective. You have to slow down. You have to be very deliberate, because you have less tools in the toolbox. Mm-hmm. And especially for a story like this, where these characters talk about things that are difficult to talk about, even in your first language.
Right.
So all of a sudden, they're doing it in English. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that's inherently theatrical. I mean, if you look at what theater's always been a celebration of language. And it's always been a place where we can honor communication and honor language and honor words. And I think it's just so happened that particular theme in my heart has become actually a much bigger part of what I love so much about being in the Barrymore now and watching this show, because we live in a world now where words have lost meaning. We live in a world now where everybody, from the president down, communicates on Twitter. That's the world we live in. Everybody, gets 120 characters or whatever it is. We don't even spell words anymore. They're just like... So I just feel like language has just become very... It's just become walked over, Mm-hmm. It's become muddy. It's become... Words have really lost their meaning in the context of our country and in the kind of world that we live in now, the tone of the world we live in. And the tone in the Barrymore at the band's visit is very different than that. It's a quiet... It's a mature, it's a contemplative world where we're going against the grain there. We're actually asking an audience to lean in. We're asking an audience to pay attention very carefully to every word that these actors are, these characters are using. And to me, that's refreshing. It feels mm-hmm. good to me. It's like getting my battery recharged. Mm-hmm. And I think that I've had the good fortune of working on this since 2017, and the world's been pretty chaotic in these last couple of years. And I've been very grateful to have a kind of a, my own sort of temple in the theater where I've gotten to be around this story a lot. And have this sort of meditative experience, and then the music and the sort of catharsis of it all is just icing on the cake.
Well, that's wonderful. So here you are at the JCC, and you say to your wife, "This intrigues me. I think I can do something with this."
Yeah.
What happens next?
I tried tracking down Aaron Gollerin, who was the filmmaker. I went to Sony, who was distributing the film. They gave me the name of his agent, which I called, and I didn't get anywhere. They weren't interested. Nobody knew who I was, and, you know, it wasn't like I was a very appealing. I didn't have anything to offer, really. I didn't have any money or experience. I just loved this show. I loved this film and this idea of adaptation. And eventually,
you had no money, and you had no experience.
Right.
Just chutzpah.
But other than that, it was a good fit. So I had passion, and I was determined to kind of see it through.
What was your wife saying?
I don't even know. I mean, she was
trying. Was she supportive, or she thought you were crazy?
She still thinks I'm crazy for so many reasons, but she's equally crazy, so it's good. We're the same kind of crazy.
Was she excited by the idea?
I think so.
You think so?
That's the way I kind of paint that memory. I don't know. I think a lot of people thought it was a weird idea and a weird impulse. A lot of people that saw the film. I always, like as a producer, I always feel like I have a group of like 10 or 20 people that I'll talk to. And I, you know, early ideas, if I have them, I will go to these 20 people and ask them what they think. But I always mix it up. There's some people where if they tell me they like the idea, I know it's bad.
Very wise.
And some people, right, if they tell me they hate the idea, I know it's good.
Okay.
So I think that's probably my own stubbornness more than anything.
Okay.
But,
so
you know, most people, I think, told me it was not a good idea. Except there was I had a young friend at the time, a young director named Max Williams, who was helping me for many years on the show. He watched the film and loved it and said, "This is a great idea."
Okay. So you're banging on the door and you're getting nowhere.
So I finally called Aaron. I got his email from my cousin in Israel, my wife's cousin, who was a TV director. And I got his personal email, and I said, "I'm coming to Tel Aviv. I'm going to come meet you. Let's have a coffee," which he agreed to do. And I think his first reaction was, "I don't want you to put all my characters into cat costumes and have them like singing and dancing, you know, because I think Cats had been the only show he'd ever seen. Because he just didn't know anything about theater, so he just wasn't interested." And I explained to him that I had no intention of putting them in cat costumes. Mm-hmm. But I did say, I posited that perhaps if he understood theater as well as he understood film, he may have chosen to make this play. And I think that's when he leaned in a little and sort of considered that and agreed to send me some old screenplays that he had that he'd never made it into the film. Some of them were hundreds of pages. I mean, characters and scenes and just all this stuff that I unearthed that never made it into the final cut of the film. And these were some beautiful writing. I had it all, it was all in Hebrew, so I had it all translated. And I think all in all, it was about 2 years before I ended up actually getting the rights.
Really? When does this start? What year?
2007 was when I saw the film.
2007.
And it opened at the Atlantic in 2016.
Almost 10 years.
Yeah, I think like maybe 2000. So it's probably, yeah, like 8 to 10 years.
Yes.
Around there. Yeah.
But it takes 2 years just to convince him to give you the right, sell you the
rights. Well, I think it took like a year just to like get his email. I was very busy. I was making a living in New York. So it took a while, you know? It took a while.
Was it hard to get the money to buy the rights?
Oh, I didn't have any money, so it was easy because I didn't have anything to offer. I think I gave him, I think maybe my first check in was like $1,500, you know, just out of
my
pocket.
So he did it because he believed in you somehow? Somehow.
Yeah, I think I also, it was probably the best offer he got.
Okay, then what happens?
And
at that point, in your mind, is it a stage play or is it a musical?
It wasn't, I honestly never thought about it.
I didn't make that decision.
No, like the first reading we ever did, we did it at the Hartford Stage in the basement of a church, my friend Max and I, and all we did is we took his screenplays and we cut and paste them into a different order so that we could kind of make it work on stage as
yes.
a sort of a linear thing.
Yes.
And we got a bunch of actor friends. We were in the basement of this church in front of 200 subscribers, And we presented it as sort of the screenplay, but we sang the song Sunny that's in it, in the disco scene. We sang Summertime. We sang a song in Hebrew that was in the film. We had a singer come in. And then at the end of the show, I really wanted there to be a song in Arabic. So at the very end of the show, we actually hired an imam from Southern Connecticut, from a mosque. And he came up, and at the end of the show, he got up on stage and sang a song in Arabic, a traditional song, which I didn't know what it meant, but it was just this sort of beautiful Arabic melody in this Middle Eastern tune, and it really was just this compliment at the end of the staged reading. And the whole audience just got it, everyone in that audience. And this was a very rough sort of, this was literally just reading the screenplay, but it kind of fed me enough confidence in the idea that I said, oh, these characters actually work on stage. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, I became a lot more confident about my impulse. Mm-hmm. And then over the years, sought out different writers. You know, when you're a young kid trying to like navigate this world, you get all sorts of things thrown at you that you're trying to just navigate. I went through a series of writers before I actually found the team that I wanted
really?
To use. Yeah.
How did that work? In other words, very often writers come to a play. You're going out to find writers.
Yeah, I was actually like finding them. Yeah, it worked well. I was going through a few different people that had submitted some ideas. Some of them I even contracted to write a draft. Some of these people I would spend a year working with and then decide after a year, this isn't what I want, and start over, you know? Eventually, I had established a relationship with Harold Prince, who's still a very dear friend and a mentor.
Had you known him from before?
Yeah, I'd known him for a little while. He had sponsored that fellowship that you had mentioned in my intro that I'd done. He was in charge of it, so he'd gotten to know me. And he fell in love with the film and this idea. And he had asked me if he could collaborate with me on it. And it was actually Hal who eventually sat me down and said, you know, you should just call this a musical. And it wasn't so much of a dramatic question as it was we were at that point looking to bring in a writing team and actually get it produced.
Yes.
And he smartly said, if you call it a musical, it's going to open up a lot of opportunities for you from a producerial perspective. It really wasn't a dramatic question because music was always a part of it. Mm-hmm. And as great as our show is and as much as I love it, you'll still get people that walk out saying, well, it's more of like a play with music, right? Because we're stretching that sort of, I believe the idea of how to define, I hope that the definition of musical theater is elastic, right?
It's yes,
just like
course.
Any other art form.
Of course.
Art is meant to be malleable. You don't want things to become stiff and stale. So the idea that we were playing with the convention of musical theater was always natural to me.
Look,
it
isn't 42nd Street.
No.
But it's definitely a musical in the sense that music is the...
flows throughout.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The other thing about this, and I'm jumping a little bit ahead, but I find the characters that were created, all of them are lovely.
Yeah.
Because very often a play is done and you like some, you don't like,
right.
Especially what could have happened. But the way the show is crafted, you like the Israelis and you like the Egyptians.
Yeah, they're all good people.
They're all good people. And the other thing, and you can tell me whether you think I'm wrong, I didn't feel it was political. I thought it was human. And we're, you know, because, and I asked you this earlier, because at the moment the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and Middle East peace is often part of any discussion that involves an Arab and a Jew. So now you've got a play about Egyptians and Israelis. And if you don't know what you're about to see, you walk in, you wouldn't be surprised if it was about conflict resolution.
Right.
That's not what this is. They happen to be Israeli, and they happen to be Egyptian. But I had the feeling that the show had much more to do with what it is to be a human being than either Egyptian or an Israeli. You think it's fair?
Yeah, we always said that. I mean, you know, the political takeaway from the show is probably more macro, you know, if you step back. But no, I mean, our director, David Cromer, He always said that. He's like, at the end of the day, if a stranger shows up at your door and he doesn't have any food to eat and he doesn't have anywhere to sleep and you're looking at this person in the eyes, most people are going to, like, help the guy out. Like, that's just what most people are going to do.
Most nice people.
Well, I think most, I'd like to believe we live in a world where that's what most people would do. Mm-hmm. And maybe there are some exceptions. But, you know, when these Egyptians show up and they're lost, it shouldn't be that shocking that these Israelis would take them in for the night. And you hope that it wouldn't be that shocking if the reverse were true. I think ultimately it's a show about people. And like us, or like me, certainly, they're all broken. You know, these are imperfect people. These are flawed people. These are people with wounds.
Each one with a different wound.
Yeah, they're broken.
Yes.
And we always actually said at the end of our show, you know, in a lot of Broadway musicals, everything has a big ending.
Yes.
And we actually have a line in the show where he's telling him how to end his concerto, and he says, maybe it's not a big end. You know, maybe it's just a quiet room and a baby's asleep. And I think that's kind of what our end is, you know. It's not meant, these people aren't cured. There's no peace in the Middle East after this trip. But I think when you have people that are stuck and that are at a point in their life where they're broken, this show kind of explains how on this one night with these random strangers, they all sort of shift just a little. They all begin to take a little baby step towards getting better in their own ways. One of them is learning how to connect with his wife and raise a child. One of them's learning how to speak to a girl. One of them's learning how to embrace, you know, the child that he lost. There's so many different themes that are just about these little steps. But they're only little from sort of a linear point of view. When you're a human being and you're in a theater and you're invested in these characters, these things are huge. Because these are the things, this is the fabric of our lives. I certainly remember having sweaty palms staring at a girl at a young age and not knowing how to approach her. I mean, that's something that I can identify with. I think I can certainly identify with what it's like to have a baby that's screaming and feeling like you've lost touch with your spouse. I mean, these are common human things. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think ultimately what you're saying is right. This is mm-hmm. not about the conflict. We also are aware of the fact that this is also a chance to look at the Middle East without that sort of 24-hour
yes.
news cycle lens,
yes.
right? That most Americans, I think, their understanding of the Middle East is through news. That's how we're presented with information. It's not anyone's fault. It's just this is the nature of the world that we live in. And if theater and film and books and art, if art can't provide us a window to actually see these places in a way that's much more sincere and much more connected to our humanity, then what will? I mean, it's a kind of these are just opportunities we have as artists to kind of present these stories in a way that hopefully some people walk out of the Barrymore thinking like, oh, that's what a night in Israel might look like. It's not all Katushas and, you know, tunnels, you know. There's just someone who's trying to talk to a girl at a roller skating rink.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause that happens too.
Waiting by the phone.
The kid waiting by the phone, right.
Mm-hmm. I love the way you say it, and I don't, and this is not to disparage anyone else, but I'm not sure. The world of Broadway producing is very complicated, very challenging. In some way, it's, you have to have courage to do it. And then people are driven a lot of different reasons. People go into theater or try to devote their life to theater. The way you describe it is so enthralling to me. And I'm thinking to myself, what it must have been like for you now to be, I don't know where, before you opened the Barrymore, where were you?
We're at the Atlantic Theater.
Atlantic, right. So are you standing in the back watching as the play begins to shape?
Yeah.
Okay. And at some point, you know, are you ever touched? And I don't know if you're a goose pimple person or not. Does the show ever give you what people say they get goose pimples? Are you ever...
Goosebumps.
Do you remember a night when you're watching it and you're saying to yourself, oh, this is, forget the fact that I'm a producer. If I were just watching this, it touches me.
I'm like a wet puddle every time I see that show. But I hope that's what it was. I remember at the previews at the Atlantic, we were doing something that was very outside the box, and we were playing with convention. We were challenging conventions in musical theater throughout the show. And so, yeah, during previews, there were nights where it was touch and go, where we were like, is this actually working? Is this not working? And then I remember like a day or so before we locked the show, which is when we invite the press in to review it, I remember there was a performance where I was next to Cromer, and the show ended, and we sort of, Cromer was in tears, and he put his hands in his arm, you know, and he put his head in his hands, and I kind of acknowledged with him. I was like, oh, yeah, it landed. Like, the show actually, we did it. It works. And it was very, it was just this very delicate line that we walked.
Yes.
And just these little tiny shifts. And
yes.
Because, you know, the show is sparse, so little things have a big impact. But eventually we sort of found the center, and then the critics responded.
Who wrote for the Times about?
Ben Brantley wrote the review,
and
twice.
And what did he say?
Just beautiful things. I encourage everyone to go read the reviews. I mean, the reviews have been beautiful across the board. The New York Times has been very supportive of us, as have most of the major theatrical publications, commending the work, commending, rightfully so, Cromer and Yazbek and Itamar and this cast, all of whom were just sort of at the top of their game, and our designers. We had this.
And people should understand, that's your responsibility. What a lead producer does is bring all those creative talents together. You can't make the set. You're not going to write the script. You're not going to write the music. But your job is to captain it. And to, as I said in the open, you drove it.
Yeah.
And so you should take enormous pride. This was, none of this ever happens by accident.
Yeah.
You know?
And no, I'm very proud.
You should be. You also had a great cast.
Great cast.
Okay, so talk about how do you get Shalhoub?
Oh, Shalhoub was somebody who I always thought would be good for it. It took me years to convince him to do it.
Really?
Yeah, he didn't, he was like, I don't sing. I remember once we had a meeting with him and Hal, and Hal was like, so do you sing? And he was like, well, I sing in the shower. He's like, you're in. And then at some point, like Tony, I remember I was in Israel at one point talking to him from Israel, because I just remember where I was standing outside of this, my cousin's house in Jerusalem. And he was like, Oren, you have to stop asking me to do this show. He's like, I actually have friends who sing. I'll introduce you to them. And I said, no, you've got to, I'll pay for you to start voice. Like, I actually put him in voice lessons for a year because he was so nervous about his singing.
Brilliant.
And I'll just never forget after the Tony Award. After he got nominated, I started calling him Pavarotti. That was my nickname for him. Because he's like, you know, he won a Tony Award for Best Actor in a Musical. He was like, this is the craziest thing that's ever happened to me.
You like him as a person?
Oh, yeah. He's the whole cast. And Katrina Lenk. And
talk about Katrina.
She's just this. You don't get better people than this. And that's just luck. I mean, we cast the best artists we could find. And they just happened to be, across the board, just incredible people. Warm, gracious. You can't ask for a better set of stars to do a show. Katrina Lenk she sets the bar.
Yes.
I mean, clearly with her talent, she sets the bar. But then on top of that, to be like lovely and humble, mm-hmm. and just, you can't do better. You really can't. I encourage every producer in the country to create work for her, because yes. you won't do better. Yes. And Tony too, just a mensch and humble, and I think everybody just came into this show with passion and cared about it sincerely, and still does. I mean, we're going to close in April with most of our original cast still on stage.
Isn't that amazing?
2 years later.
Amazing. There's one more person I'm going to mention. I mean, you have a wonderful cast, but John Cariani.
Mm-hmm.
And John and I have been friends for a long time, and I was producing with Julian Schlossberg a gamillion years ago, and he was in an off Broadway show of ours starring F. Marie Abraham called It's My Party and I'll Die If I Want To. And he's playing the Undertaker, and he is fabulous.
Yeah, he's a good actor.
And he also, you know, he's a playwright too. And he has his Almost Maine is wonderful. And he's, you know, been in musicals and
No, he does everything.
He does everything.
A quadruple threat.
And I love Julian also too. Lovely, lovely, lovely person.
Yeah, just like incredible. You just can't do better.
Okay. So now, as you look at the Broadway theater as a whole, what's your sense of where it is going? What makes you, you know, pleased with it? And where do you feel the challenges are?
I love being in this business. I'm very involved in the touring business. I've been my whole adult life. I think it's immensely popular right now. Hamilton has created a surge in this industry that's fantastic for everyone, and it's exciting and it's deserved. And it's put the focus on quality, which I think is always good for this business. It's always good for the industry. We're always we live in a world where, you know, Broadway is a very limited amount of real estate, and that's always a challenge with us. You know, in the movies, you can really kind of make as many as you want. There's lots of theaters, and if there aren't, you can always build more. But Broadway, what's unique about it is that it's just a set number of Broadway houses that
exist.
You
have a limited number.
And so there's only so much product that can get put into it. And when you get into a world where the larger sort of more corporate approach to producing theater becomes more and more prevalent, which I don't have a problem with, because I think a lot of the theater that's done with some of the studios is remarkable. But it certainly can become more challenging to be an independent producer and find your own way in. I think now there's a very high bar that you have to cross in order to get into that and to find the real estate in order to get your shows up. There's a lot of money in Broadway right now, so there's a lot of opportunity for young producers to capitalize shows and get their ideas off the ground. And I hope that the band's visit having financial success on Broadway gives an opportunity to other producers who are like-minded, who are trying to maybe be unconventional mm-hmm. about things. Mm-hmm. It's just challenging to do that in any art form. So I think it's remarkable that theater, Broadway, is still able to, for something like the band's visit to exist and be commercial. I said it in an interview a long time ago, and I always remember this line because I read it later in print, and I was pleased with myself. But as someone said, it was early in the run on Broadway, and they said, do you really think this is commercial? You really think the band's visit is commercial? And I said, I don't know, but I want to live in a world where it is, you know? And that's how I feel. And so now we've proven that it can be, and so that gives me hope.
Yes.
You know, for Broadway, for this country, for the world, you know.
That is wonderful. I'm hoping, by the way, the success you've had with band's visit makes it a little bit easier for you to do some other creative things you want to do.
It has, yeah. Now I have the ability to develop things hopefully more quickly and do other projects with greater ease. And the band's visit's going on tour, so we're going to be playing across the U.S. for the next 2 years.
Okay, so if people don't get to see it in New York, but you're being seen right now, not only globally, but you're seeing all over the United States.
Good.
Where's the tour going to go?
Well, we tech it and launch it in Providence, Rhode Island, then we go to the Kennedy Center, and we have a list of cities, and we'll I guess we can put the website
on
the
website?
On the screen.
Absolutely. What's the website?
Thebandsvisitmusical.com, but the tour is going to be the replica of the Broadway show. It's going to be this production, and it's going to be extraordinary.
Who's the cast?
We haven't announced our cast
okay.
yet, but we're working on it. It's going to be a top of the line cast,
okay.
which we're really excited about.
Will you travel a little bit with it?
Yeah, I'll be in and out. I usually go and see my tours every few weeks.
So, you know, now everybody knows what you look like. So if they see you in the back of the theater, they'll come say hello to you.
That's good. Good. But only say nice things.
You are fabulous.
Thanks.
This has been such a joy for me.
Oh, great. Well,
I wish you Kol Tuv V'Hatzlacha, only much success.
Thank you.
Everywhere you go. And I hope, you know, the next time you do a production, you'll come back and you'll sit and talk to me
sure.
some more.
Sounds good.
But it has been lovely meeting you.
Terrific.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Broadway producer Oren Wolf, whose musical The Band's Visit won 10 Tony Awards, including Best Musical. And remember, The Band's Visit will close April 7th. So if you haven't seen it, make a point of getting tickets right away. As always, I invite you to be in touch with me with any thoughts or comments you may have to any of the ideas expressed on this edition of L'Chaim. Please email me, write me, post on our Facebook page, or tweet me. I look forward to hearing from many of you. Until the next time, I'm Mark Golub. L'Chaim, my friends, life.
Jewish Education in Media.
We would be pleased to send a complimentary DVD of this program to anyone who wishes to support JBS with a tax-deductible gift of $36, double chai, or more. Simply visit the JBS website at jbstv.org and click on the Donate button to make a donation by PayPal or your credit card. And please, indicate the program for which you would like a DVD. Or you can send your tax-deductible check to JBS, P.O. Box 180, Riverdale Station, Bronx, New York, 10471. And again, please remember to indicate which program you would like to receive with our compliments. And we thank you for your kind support.